I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. Martin Luther King speaking April 3, 1968. Within 24 hours, he would be dead. Assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April 4, 1968. Today is the federal holiday that honors him. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godarz, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you ever listening to a new pop song or reminiscing over an old, well-loved album? And you catch a melody or a lick that reminds you of a different album altogether? Next thing you know, you're reading about the profound influence of synthesizers on rock and roll? Well then join me, Katie Zip, for Double Groove, a genre-bending show where we'll take a deep dive into an album, exploring the influences, history, and take a few quirky turns, all for maximum enjoyment and understanding of the music we love. Every second Friday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m., it's Double Groove with Katie Zip, only on your community radio station, KBOO, on 90.7 FM.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you don't want to miss it. To snag your copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
My favorite Let's Talk About Race episode is one that I've shared over and over again, and I want to talk about why it's my favorite. So my favorite is the Happy Birthday, Malcolm X and Yuri. As many people know, Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama shared a birthday. And not only did they share a birthday, they shared a respect and a love and a solidarity with each other that was based in their mutual understanding of each one of their roles as a person of color in America. One of the reasons that I like this episode quite a bit is the song by the Blue Scholars that talks about, I want to be like Yuri Kuchiyama when I grow up, when I get real, when I get, you know, and it talks about young people who don't know her, who may look at her and say, oh, she was in the past, she's old, she's Asian, she's whatever. And when you find out what this woman did and who she stood with and who she, what she stood for, you understand that we all actually want to be a little bit like Yuri Kuchiyama. In fact, if we were, it might actually help us on the pathway to this revolutionary love that I like to talk about. Another reason I like this episode quite a lot is that it gives evidence for a narrative that contradicts the narrative that says Asian people and African American people are naturally at odds and in competition with each other. There are true issues of conflict and challenges of understanding and proximity to whiteness and anti-blackness that actually have to be dealt with between and among our communities. However, it is not a natural condition that Asians and African Americans should be at odds or in competition with each other. And this friendship is one of many, but a very important example of that. And the other reason that I like this episode is it starts to help us understand a little bit better about who Malcolm X was and what he stood for. There is the narrative that says that Martin Luther King Jr. was the good one and Malcolm X was the bad one because one espoused this and one espoused that. And I think, as any of us who've done any reading know, that as these two men continued on their pathway towards revolutionary love, they both started to see the commonality of their struggle and the compatibility of their approaches and the way in which they viewed the world and analyzed the world. And they both were on a pathway to moving closer towards each other in a revolutionary love. And again, that term revolutionary, you might associate with Malcolm, and love, you might associate with Martin. And this idea of coming together for revolutionary love is quite an exciting one to me. And again, our narratives say there's got to be a good one and there's got to be a bad one. We've all heard way too much about you're the right kind of person of color, you're not the right kind of person of color, that is completely based in white supremacy culture. And I love that our show begins to explore that and to humanize. And, you know, the idea of a birthday, an anniversary of someone's natal experience on this earth, and to have that be shared by two iconic people is a wonderful thing that I think we have gotten to explore in the show.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama. On this edition of Let's Talk About Race, we are diverting from our regular programming to celebrate the May 19th birthdays of Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama. On paper, Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X made an unexpected pair. A Japanese-American mother of six and a Muslim minister, black nationalist, and human rights activist. Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama had a revolutionary friendship that was interrupted by Malcolm X's assassination in 1965. And at the assassination of Malcolm X, Yuri was there. May 19th is the birthday of both Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X. As we celebrate their birthdays, Yuri and Malcolm's revolutionary friendship highlighted the multiracial cooperation of the civil rights movement and the broader fight against racial injustice around the world. With the music of Blues Scholars, Grassroots News invites our listeners to celebrate the revolutionary friendship of Yuri Kuchiyama and Malcolm X on their birthdays, May 19th. This is Malcolm X.
Malcolm X is an extraordinary figure for whom African Americans have this deep affinity.
Malcolm X is one of the most historic and most significant human beings in American history.
Malcolm Little was born May 19, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. His father, Earl Little, was an outspoken Baptist minister and supporter of Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. His push for civil rights made him the target of death threats, forcing the family to move several times. In 1929, their home in Michigan was burned to the ground, and 2 years later, Earl was found dead. This was a devastating blow for Malcolm's mother, who was eventually committed to a mental institution. Her 8 children were sent to orphanages and foster homes. In school, Malcolm was a smart and focused student until he told his teacher in high school he wanted to become a lawyer.
He wanted to be a lawyer, but they told him that they said niggers don't get to be lawyers. So that's an unreasonable goal for a nigger. And so to some extent, America created Malcolm X. So those are the forces that made him into the person that he eventually became.
He dropped out and moved to Boston. Over the next few years, he held various jobs and moved from Boston to Flint, Michigan, to Harlem in New York, and finally back to Boston. During this period, he started his street career as a pimp, drug dealer, and gambler. In 1946, he was arrested for burglary and sent to prison. In prison, he began reading everything he could get a hold of. Inspired by his brother Reginald's conversion to Islam, Malcolm read the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. Malcolm dropped his slave name, Little, and chose X to represent his lost tribal name. By the time he was paroled in 1952, he had committed himself to the Nation of Islam. He was a very charismatic and powerful speaker who conveyed Elijah Muhammad's teaching to the masses. He was appointed national spokesman. During this time, membership increased from 500 to 30,000.
Malcolm emerged as this extraordinarily talented, itinerant minister. And he preached a creed of black superiority that blacks controlled themselves.
In 1958, Malcolm X married Betty X in Lansing, Michigan. The couple had 6 daughters, including twins Malak and Malika, born in 1965 after their father's death and named for him. Malcolm X rejected the civil rights movement's use of nonviolent protest. Instead, he encouraged black men to use any means necessary to protect themselves.
That Malcolm's clarion call for blacks to mobilize and fight against racism inspired millions of African Americans, even those who disagreed with him. They respected him as a person, as a man.
Malcolm's faith was challenged when he found out that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had seduced several women in the Nation of Islam, and some had bore his children. In 1964, Malcolm X renounced Elijah Muhammad and left the Nation of Islam. He founded a religious organization, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and took a pilgrimage to the Holy Land of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. In Mecca, he met people of all races he could call his brothers. He renamed himself El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz and returned to the U.S. with new hope for the future. He founded the Organization of Afro-American Unity to unite blacks all over the world. Malcolm was seen as a threat to the Nation of Islam, and he was informed that members were plotting to assassinate him. His home was firebombed, but he and his family were unharmed. On February 21, 1965, Malcolm started a presentation at the Audubon Ballroom in New York when 3 gunmen ran up and shot him 15 times at close range. He was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital.
This is Yuri Kochiyama.
It is the story of a 73-year-old Japanese-American whose life in Harlem turned her into a political activist. She was inspired by Malcolm X, and she's been fighting for human rights ever since the 60s.
I came to Harlem at a very good time politically. It was 1960 when everything was popping because black people were fighting for civil rights, not only down south but up here. And so I think when we came here to Harlem and all this was happening, it was so good for our family. I mean, we all became educated, you know, politicalized.
The question we put to this commission is, how does the government...
It was 1960 when Yuri Kachiyama, her late husband Bill, and their six children moved into the newly built projects on 126th Street in Harlem.
We joined Harlem Parents Committee, which is not a radical group, but it's a very good civil rights organization, and they were fighting for better schools. We met all the civil rights kind of people. But then when we would go down the streets and hear street speakers, well, we got more interested in what was happening on the streets, and that would be more like Malcolm X group.
She met Malcolm in 1963 at a court hearing. She had been arrested while protesting.
Malcolm X seemed so radical, and if you remember way back then, all the media just crucified him. They tried to smash him, make him seem like such a hate monger, when all he was doing, he was just being very pro-black and fighting for his own people. I joined his organization and used to go to the Audubon to hear him speak, and also began going to his liberation school. But he came here to meet with some of the writers of the Hiroshima Nagasaki World Peace Study Mission because they wanted to meet Malcolm more than any other person in the United States. I think they were curious to know why the U.S. government would be so afraid of just one black leader.
After that meeting in her home, Yuri and Malcolm became good friends. She treasures the postcards he sent from his travels.
He sent about 11 of them from about 9 different countries. And this one is from Kenya. It says, "Greetings from Kenya, the home of those great African patriots, the Mau Mau freedom fighters." And then from Kuwait, he sent this one saying, "Still trying to travel and broaden my scope since I've learned what a mess can be made by narrow-minded people."
My priority would be to fight against polarization because this whole society is so polarized. I think there are so many issues that all people of color should come together on. And there are forces in this country who want this polarization to take place.
As a woman, and specifically an Asian American woman, she is very unique. And when we talked to people when we were doing this project, time and time again, people talked about her ability to work across, I guess, what you would call cultural lines.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, a revolutionary friendship of Malcolm X and Yuri Kochiyama.
I'm joined with my producer co-host,
Tenny Yokoyama.
We are here to discuss the revolutionary friendship between Yuri and Malcolm X, Yuri Kochiyama.
Perfect.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas. When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hears this, it's an honor. Because when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
Here comes Yuri Kochiyama, who... You know, she kind of just started off as like a middle class person, and then she gets put in these camps. And then when she comes out, she becomes this revolutionary activist for, especially for the Japanese American community. She was seen as just being absolutely over the top extremist.
We didn't have all the rights that Caucasians had, and it was because of racism. And of course, when December 7th happened, it was also hysteria and Americans also looked at December 7th from a very economic point of view. I mean, Japan had been working the land. I mean, she was given only the worst kind of desert land, and she made it fertile. And so other farmers, Caucasians, it would be to their advantage if the Japanese were thrown out and they could work the land. So I think on what are the civil rights we lost, I think, well, we never had all the civil rights. I think a lot of Japanese felt they weren't treated like a real American.
On December 7th, 1941, the Empire of Japan launched an attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. In the following months, hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans were rounded up and sent to internment camps under suspicion of disloyalty to the United States. But the feelings that paved the road to internment began long before the attack. For more than 80 years, Asian immigrants were viewed as economic threats, spurring various laws that effectively banned them from the country. For those who made it to America, the lingering resentment culminated after Pearl Harbor. Motivated by vocal outcries from politicians and military officials, FDR signed Executive Order 9066, empowering the U.S. Army to designate areas from which any or all persons may be excluded. He later formed the War Relocation Authority to establish 10 permanent camps, housing nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans, mostly from the Western United States. Two-thirds of those interned were native-born American citizens. With only 6 days to dispose of their possessions, residents were forced to sell their belongings and even their homes for small sums of money. Internment camps were often situated in isolated deserts, prone to harsh weather, and surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers. Within the barracks, internees lived in small one-room apartments with little privacy and constant surveillance. They were only given a standard army cot, blankets, and a small heating stove. Despite these difficult living conditions, internees tried to establish a sense of community, creating newspapers, schools, churches, and farms. Even in the face of persecution, young men came forth to join the military. Nearly 33,000 Japanese Americans served during World War II, many of whom became highly decorated for their valor in battle. Yet as the war continued, public opinion worsened against Japanese Americans. Only 35% of the country thought they should be allowed home once the war was over. This sentiment kept the camps open for over 3 years. On December 17, 1944, the government announced that Japanese American evacuees could return to their homes. When they did return, they found their homes looted and their possessions gone. With work almost impossible to come by, many fell homeless and destitute. At the time, the federal government offered no assistance for those attempting to rebuild their lives. It would take over 40 years before President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, paying reparations to each victim of internment.
No payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our commitment as a nation to equal justice under the law.
Why do you think she was so attracted to Malcolm X? Because for African Americans, and full disclosure, I'm a woman of color, I'm African American and Native, you're Japanese American, we don't have many revolutionary bonds, except your people were placed in an internment camp during World War II. Mm-hmm. Ironically, for World War II, for African Americans, it was the road out of those plantations in the South, yeah. You know, the Great Migration. And here in Harlem, these two human beings connected.
Malcolm, can I shake your hands too? Because all these young people were. And he said, what for? And I didn't know first what to say. What for? I said, because what you're doing for your people. And he said, and what am I doing for my people? You're giving directions.
Get off the welfare. Get out of that compensation line. Be a man. Earn what you need for your own family. Then your family respects you. They are proud to say, that's my father. She's proud to say, that's my husband. Father means you're taking care of those children. Just because you made them, that don't mean you're a father. Anybody can make a baby. Right. But anybody can take care of them. That's right. Anybody can go and get a woman. But anybody can take care of a woman. Right. So husband means you're taking care of your wife. Right. Father means you are taking care of your children. You are accepting the responsibilities of manhood.
And then he just changed and said, he came out of that, the center of that, you know, where everybody was there, came out and he stuck his hand out, so I ran and grabbed it. I couldn't believe that I was shaking Malcolm X's hand.
Very different paths, very different realities in America, and yet they developed a revolutionary friendship.
People told us, Malcolm's not going to go to your house. He doesn't know you, and it's dangerous for him right now. What made you think that he might come? Well, I said, well, it's true, I'm not sure. I wrote to him, I did not hear from him, but his office called and said they would do whatever they could that he might come. And he did. And our place was jam-packed. We lived in a housing project in Harlem. And I wasn't sure he was going to come, so I didn't want to advertise it too much and have people come, and then they'll wonder what happened and he didn't come. But a lot of people showed. Our house was jam-packed, and Malcolm did come, and we were all so surprised and just so tickled. People were really more amazed that he would take the chance of coming to a strange home of people he didn't even know anything about, when there were so many rumors that something might happen to Malcolm. And when he did come, of course, the people were just so excited. Everybody wanted to shake his hand. They didn't know if he would shake the hands of white people or what. But Malcolm just surprised everyone. He was so warm to everyone, no matter what color. And people were just astounded that Malcolm has that wonderful way. He's so down to earth.
It makes a lot of sense to me, because when you look at the Japanese community coming out of World War II, there weren't a lot of people talking that way. You know, they were really inspired. The Asian American movement was inspired by the civil rights movement.
People barely know about Asian American activism. It's becoming more visible to the mainstream in the most recent period. We have a very long and rich history of protest and active organizing against racism and for transformative change for liberatory communities. For example, in Hawaii in 1920, to protest the work conditions on the sugarcane plantations in Hawaii, the Japanese and Filipino sugarcane workers united and had a huge industry-wide strike.
Mobilization was largely ethnic specific, but you know, notably that changed in the 1960s, of course, with the civil rights movement, free speech movement, anti-Vietnam War movement, and the emergence of the Asian American movement itself, you know, that brought together Americans of various Asian ancestries. So the term Asian American itself is a political coinage that reflects this emphasis on unity. The Asian American movements also work in multiracial and transnational solidarity with other groups, both in the United States, but also with people in the developing world who are fighting against racism, neo-imperialism, racialized labor exploitation, structural inequities such as access to housing, food, and healthcare that bound them together. In the 1980s, you know, when Southeast Asian refugees first arrived in the United States from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, Southeast Asian parents and Latinx parents worked together to ensure bilingual support for their children and equitable access to the curriculum for their children. You've got Grace Lee Box, who is a dedicated advocate and long-term advocate for African-American communities.
Asian-American and activism seems like oxymorons, which they are not. Studying Asian American activism, it changes, it transforms us, I think, to think of ourselves as connected to a history of resistance and protest. It changes how we think change happens in society. It is through hard work, it is through education, but it isn't only through that.
Really want to encourage the younger generation of Asian Americans, you know, to really delve into these histories, to learn not just about the particularities of the challenges facing our communities, but also these kind of long and intertwined histories of solidarity, of coalitional politics, right? It is critically important for all of us to be at the table speaking about this, and for allies, you know, to come together and support communities that may not have the resources, that may not have the platform.
Really not just struggle for the low-hanging fruit, not just struggle for the things that are actionable items that we can do kind of in the immediate, because so often those turn into transactional reforms, when what we really need is long-haul social movement building. There's something that happens when we dream big and when we have a radical imagination. We begin to see the world that we actually want. People are talking about a lot, right, which is self-care. And I'd like to think about it as collective care. And this is a lesson that I've really learned from Yuri Kochiyama. And she's, of course, best known for having worked with Malcolm X. She always cared about the political prisoners. She would tell people it's their birthdays, you need to send them a card. She always asked people how they were. They think it's really important that we take time to take care of ourselves, whatever that means. And I think to be reflective and to slow down.
And they said, oh, no one from our community is speaking this way. Oh, we're allowed to speak that way? I don't think they knew they were allowed to speak that way. So she was really inspired by what he had to say. And, you know, she was from California, and she didn't return to California after World War II because I think she was a little bitter